Good morning. This is Climate Winter, and I'm your host, Julie Hantman, live on Tacoma Radio 94.3 FM and streaming at tacomaradio.org. We're here in Tacoma Park, Maryland, right on the border of D.C. And D.C. is the champion this month because 12 days ago, we got a brand new ambitious law signed into law by Mayor Bowser to get the city to a clean energy future fast and help do our part to fight off climate change. I'll be speaking today to two guests who were deep in the trenches on this bill, and they're sitting here with me, Chelsea Hodgkins, hello.
Hi.
And Jamie DeMarco, hello.
Good morning.
And they're going to talk about what the law does, what it took to get there, what's next, some implications, and then some thoughts about what this meant for them personally. But first, when I named the show Climate Winter, I did not expect it to be so very timely. We are a little bundled up here in the studio, and it'll be about zero or less tonight in the D.C. area, but everyone knows by now the Midwest and Maine, much of the country is experiencing extremely cold weather. Polar vortex bursting southward, invading the U.S. with record-shattering wintry weather and life-threatening cold. As I hope listeners all know, that global warming does not mean everything gets warm. We still have winter. We still can have cold. It's apparently colder in Chicago than parts of Antarctica. These things may happen more often, and scientists hedge a little bit, but basically this is because of changes to the jet stream. We've got some head-swinging weather from the California wildfires last summer. Of course, it's scorching in Australia right now, and now this. We have a lot of work to do, and there's a lot that can be done to mitigate and prevent some of the climate effects that we hope we don't see. So that's why we're here on community radio, addressing it together, opening our eyes and celebrating our progress and inviting everyone to get more involved. Let's get back to the Clean Energy DC law. It's officially called Clean Energy DC Omnibus Amendment Act, and we'll call it the Clean Energy DC Act, and get back to my guests. Now, it takes a cast of thousands to go from ideas to a bill to a law. The District Council, the legislative body of D.C., they were unanimous on this bill, and Council Member Mary Che, head of the Transportation and Environment Committee, major leader on this, the Department of Energy and Environment, many, many stakeholders involved. But Chelsea and Jamie, sitting here, are members of an important coalition, D.C. Climate Coalition, advocates working with the public interest in mind, and they came out swinging early, sat at the table, and stayed to the bitter end. I'm so happy to have them here. Chelsea Hodgkins, I'll introduce her first. First, she worked for the Chesapeake Climate Action Network here in Tacoma Park, and she's still working as a point person on the coalition to see implementation through. She's a former Fulbright scholar who worked in Ghana on water and solar energy policy. She's formerly at FEMA as well and currently works for a renewable energy communications firm. Jamie DeMarco, he is with the Citizens Climate Lobby that promotes carbon pricing legislation at state levels. He has worked with the Maryland Clean Energy Jobs Campaign and formerly with the Friends Committee on National Legislation. So let's finally get to my guests. Who can give us just a quick overview, 20,000-foot view of the bill and why it's important?
This legislation is the strongest climate legislation anywhere in the country. With the passage of this bill, D.C. is on track to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions about 45% by 2030, which is right around where the IPCC says the world needs to go to be compatible with a 1.5 degrees Celsius world. That means the world doesn't heat more than 1.5 degrees Celsius. DC is now the only jurisdiction in the country that actually has concrete laws on the books getting us at the emission reductions needed by the IPCC. So this is incredible. It requires the district to have 100% clean electricity by 2032. And for those keeping score, that's more than a decade ahead of California. It also requires every building in D.C. that's over 10,000 square feet to meet certain energy efficiency standards, even if it's an existing building. That hasn't been done anywhere in the world outside of Tokyo. It also puts a small price on carbon and uses that money to help fund these energy efficiency retrofits. It also makes gas guzzlers more expensive and uses that money to make fuel-efficient cars more affordable to more people, and requires fleets from privately owned entities that have a fleet of more than 50 vehicles in the district to be 100% electric vehicles by 2045.
That is a terrific summary. Thank you, Jamie. And we're going to get a little bit more into each of those pieces. Now, the headline that often is talked about, we'll move to Chelsea now, is that DC is going to 100% renewables by 2032. And that's part of what will take us to the virtually 50% cut in emissions that Jamie was talking about. So Chelsea, can you explain that? 100% sounds very, very impressive. 100% renewables by 2032. Does that mean we are building windmills on 16th Street? What does it mean that DC is going 100%?
Yeah, it doesn't quite mean that. It does mean a lot of really good things, particularly for solar in the district. There is a 10% carve out for solar energy that is a part of the 100% renewables, and that standard needs to be met by 2041. But right now, you can think of our electricity as just being produced, and the only way to guarantee that you know where it's coming from is through a renewable energy credit. So before, what we had is electricity was being produced. If you wanted to buy renewables, you'd have to opt in with Pepco or whoever your provider was, or a local solar cooperative, and therefore know that your electricity was, 100% emissions free. Now what this bill does is it makes it easier. So instead of having to opt in, people are going to have to opt out. That's huge. I just want to take a pause there to let that sink in, because what this means is that consumers no longer have to wonder where their energy is coming from. They can feel good turning on the light switch and knowing that it's not going to be highly polluting. So going back to the renewable energy credits, you can think of these as the currency of the renewable energy world. So now anytime a renewable energy credit is bought, it not only guarantees you that your electricity is renewable, but what it also does is it helps expand those local markets. It builds the demand and makes sure that, our electricity is also going to be sourced from places like DC, Maryland, and Virginia.
So utilities are having to buy these RECs, so I understand. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
And largely that's done through power purchase agreements. We can get into a little bit of that later in the segment. But right now, the other part to ensure that your electricity is coming from local sources is that DC is currently a part of the PJM Interconnection. That is a sort of regional organization of 13 states. And this bill ensures that our electricity is only coming from that interconnection.
Right. So it actually increases the proportion of electrons whizzing around that grid that come from renewables.
Exactly.
Fantastic. I heard the White House is going to be on renewables. They are not somehow separate from this DC 100% renewables. That is so interesting to me.
Yeah, we're super excited about that. I mean, we as activists definitely had a cheer when this bill was passed, just knowing that, as our president goes about making whatever claims he wants to make, that climate change isn't happening and refuting science that we know is true, he's going to flip on his light switch and sit in those rooms having these meetings, and it's going to come from clean energy. I mean, what can be better than that?
All right, let's take a short break. And after that, we'll talk about what some of those other pieces that Jamie mentioned, how the law is going to reduce the energy used and ensure everyone can afford being part of the energy transformation. Stay tuned. Oh, Lord, we're gonna rock down to Electric Avenue, and then we'll take it higher. Oh, we're gonna rock down to Electric Avenue, and then we'll take it higher. Who is to blame in what country? Never can get to the one. This is Climate Winter on Tacoma Radio 94.3 FM and tacomaradio.org. Again, I'm Julie Hantman, talking now with Jamie DeMarco of the Citizens Climate Lobby. Jamie, you mentioned it before, but can you go into a little more detail about buildings? In DC, we don't have major factories, we don't have factory farms, other industry. So what counts for a lot of energy usage are the many, many buildings that make up a city. So, Jamie, the law kind of cracks down on energy use in buildings, right? And how? Can you go into that?
You're absolutely right that about 3/4 of all the greenhouse gas emissions from the District of Columbia come from buildings. If you think of District of Columbia, it's buildings. And so there are already existing laws that require new buildings to be energy efficient. And those exist in a lot of places. They save everyone a lot of money. But this DC is now the first jurisdiction outside of Japan where existing buildings are actually required by law to meet certain energy efficiency standards. So the way it will work is first, every building will be sort of classified as either residential, commercial, whatever other sort of half dozen group of kinds of buildings there can be. And then for every kind of building, there will be a sort of benchmark, the sort of like middle average amount of energy efficiency. And then if your building is below that energy efficiency middle, you will be required to make your building more energy efficient. So everyone will be soon above what is now the average. So if you have already invested in energy efficiency in your building, maybe you voluntarily made your building LEED certified, then you are already above the average and you are already saving money and you're ahead of the game. And this law advantages you. But to everyone who's sort of been lagging behind, maybe they never got around to making that financially wise investment, this is now the impetus for them to do that.
You know what always bothers me? I go into, let's say, a building that has my doctor's office, and as soon as I get near the door opens. Or CVS, oh my gosh, they're the worst offenders. You are not even going into CVS, and it opens. Sorry, CVS. Is that kind of example? What are some other examples about what buildings need to do to kind of, you know, batten down the hatches to reduce energy use?
Yeah, so that's a good example. I think something as simple as windows and getting those retrofitted, but really there's a lot of systems that control how your energy functions. And so the bigger picture of how buildings can get from A to Z really quickly are replacing things like their HVAC, making sure that they have light systems and water systems that are turning off and on if a certain motion doesn't happen. And shout out to the American Geophysicists Union because they're a great example of creating a net zero building that I think moving forward, a lot of buildings in the district, when we're imagining these energy performance standards, will be going to. And if I can also comment, like some of the comments that we heard as we were going through the process of creating this bill and some of the concerns were, okay, well, where am I going to get the money to do that? So that's where the Green Bank comes in, right? So Mayor Bowser, 2 years ago, the law was put forth for the Green Finance Authority. And so in this bill, there's actually guaranteed funding for the Green Bank, and that's going to help owners to meet those standards.
So wait, so your typical building owner can pull some money to help them do this?
So there's an application process, of course. Okay. They're in the process of setting up the board. So Green Banks, just to let people know, are sort of like your standard bank, but they're only focused on sustainability programs.
Cool. How can the many low-income folks in this city participate in the good transition to clean energy that we're talking about?
Yeah, so some of the wins that we had in the bill, our coalition, one thing I really appreciated about it was very much a foundation was making sure that everybody had access to these programs and making sure that we had people in the rooms that were representative of those voices. So some of the major wins are that 30% of increases in the Sustainable Energy Trust Fund fee, which district consumers are already paying into. The increase is going to be less than a third of a penny, which is great. But 30% of that is going to go to designated programs for low-income residents, including workforce development training, which is huge. Another win that we had is that $3 million annually is starting in 2022, has to go to affordable housing providers. A lot of times there are challenges with making sure that buildings are up to codes in order to meet some of these standards. And I think last but certainly not least, one of our huge wins is that there's going to be a whole new program for building existing businesses' capacities to be able to integrate people into the clean energy economy that's being mm-hmm. developed.
Mm-hmm. Both of you have talked about these small fees. Each consumer will be seeing a small increase where on their energy bill to help collectively fund some of the programs you're talking about. Is that right?
Yeah. So okay. This is technically including a small price on carbon. And we know that pricing carbon is actually the most effective way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Just like 90%+ of scientists agree, based on the evidence, that humans are causing climate change. Very similarly, 90%+ of economists are convinced, based on the evidence, that pricing carbon is the most efficient way to reduce.
Let's just do one more thing that the law does that's pretty interesting. You know, there's bike lanes, there's metro. Not every effort to get from one place to the other is by a car, but we do have a lot of vehicles, cars and trucks and buses through DC. What does the bill do to reduce emissions from transportation, Chelsea?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing, as Jamie alluded to earlier, was that it takes the district to 100% electrified transit by 2045. There are a lot of minor steps to get there. Well, not minor, but a lot of steps to get there. But some of the things that are going to start to be happening in the immediate term is the vehicle excise tax, which Jamie had alluded to earlier. That's going to incentivize people who buy cars that are more fuel efficient to pay a lower tax for excise. One of the concerns we heard was, okay, well, oftentimes communities who are living in low-income areas don't have the money to buy those vehicles. So there is an exclusion for people who qualify for the district earned income tax credit.
Okay.
But I think it is a really good start. And the other thing that I am personally really excited about with the transportation initiatives is that every vehicle operating in the district will have to go to electrified transit. That means Uber drivers, taxis. And so that's huge when you think about borders being fluid. So anybody from Maryland or Virginia that's going to end up driving here is going to need to start considering this too. And hopefully it's going to incentivize Maryland and Virginia to take those same sorts of steps forward.
Vehicles that are certified in DC.
Exactly.
Have to go electric.
Exactly.
Right? And anyone who doesn't know what an excise tax is, I bought literally my first car at a tender age of 50 a few years ago. And it's like a medium efficiency. I guess it was a Honda Accord beat up thing, 2006. And we paid, I think, I just looked at my credit card bill, $499 in excise tax. So since it's not too great on energy efficiency, I'd probably be paying in the future that same car. I don't know. Not sure if we have calculators here, but a bit more.
Yeah.
And others will pay less if they have a more. Okay, very cool. All right, so I think we got that under our belt. Next up, some of the drama of how ideas become a bill, how a bill becomes a law. Stay tuned.
Oh, baby, come to the stroll in my automobile. Oh, baby, stroll in my automobile. I got a cool little car, baby, and everything gonna be just fine. Convertible top, wheels are just round in style.
This is Climate Winter on Tacoma Radio 94.3 FM, streaming live at tacomaradio.org. I'm Julie Hantman, talking with Jamie DeMarco of the Citizens Climate Lobby and Chelsea Hodgkins of DC Climate Coalition about DC's new energy law, the Clean Energy DC Act. So take us back. Initially, was it 2016, I think, things got going. Chesapeake Climate Action Network hired some folks and started pushing a very specific policy that they were going to promote to district council. And you started into it before, Jamie. Let's talk about a carbon price.
Right. So, like you said, the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, based right here in Tacoma Park, hired Camilla Thorndike, who I think is one of the greatest organizers in the country, to launch this campaign. And originally, it was a price on carbon with money going back to residents. And this is a really beautiful, elegant kind of policy. It mirrors legislation that was recently introduced in Congress, the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. That legislation would reduce U.S. emissions 40% in 12 years and has Republican support. So that is the kind of legislation that was introduced originally into this campaign. And there was a coalition built around the idea, as you bring in more groups. The policy changes a little bit. It went from returning all of the revenue to residents to returning 70% of the revenue, I believe, and investing the rest in specific programs. And then around that idea of putting a price on carbon that rises, making fossil fuels more expensive, making polluters pay a penalty every time they use these dirty fuels, which makes a lot of sense. Every time we use these fuels, we are incurring damage on all of our neighbors locally and globally. There is a very known amount of damage that is caused, and this is just adjusting for that externality and then taking the revenue raised and returning it back to people to make sure that we are not hurting those who are lower income, working class, or middle class.
So that they may be paying more at the pump, for example, among other things, but the dividend would help make up for that.
That's right. You would be getting a check every month with your name on it that you could deposit or directly deposit in your bank account. So maybe the price at the pump would go up, but you'd be getting a monthly amount. We know that wealthy people, on average, use more energy than low and middle income folks. So because everyone is getting the exact same amount back every month, it is the wealthy who use more energy who will come out behind every month, and the rest of us who will actually be getting more in our pocket every month.
Mm-hmm. The term that helps me out is economy-wide. So it would be an economy-wide price on carbon wherever fossil fuels are used throughout the economy. And, you know, people can imagine pushback. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But let's stick to these early days when the coalition was getting together its proposal.
So around that idea, the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and others built the strongest, largest, most diverse coalition ever built behind a climate bill in D.C.
Yes. And actually, yesterday I spoke with one of the campaign's early organizers who came before Chelsea, Jeremiah Lowry, who is a pretty well-known activist in D.C., was on board with CCAN, Chesapeake Climate Action Network. And he reminded us that, as you said, the plan was to build a really diverse coalition. Why? Because they knew the utilities and others would push back on a carbon fee and they needed firepower. They wanted to show that the climate movement was not just made up of environmentalists, and that's huge throughout the climate advocacy world. I didn't start out being an environmentalist. I'm a mom, right, who cares about the future. So they got Ben's Chili Bowl. They got individual businesses. They got moms groups. They got a teachers union on board. So this was a lot of work doing that kind of outreach. And then Jeremiah said the greatest moment was he got two groups on, the local chapter of SEIU, Service Workers Union, and the Washington Legal Clinic for the Homeless. Those two exemplified that lower income people are concerned about climate change and also want to benefit and also wanted to make sure that whatever was passed wasn't going to further hurt the poor. So you had a lot of people at that table, probably friends locked in a closed room trying to hammer out, as you said, a bill with a lot of complexity. So that's really what it was like. And then they began to shop their package, their idea, to council member Mary Che, who again was the power person in the council on anything environmental. And she showed interest, but there was skepticism that persisted, I think, on her part and others throughout the year. So let's just jump ahead and talk about this last year and some of the drama. Jamie, do you want to describe some of that?
So Mary Che was the lead sponsor of this bill and a champion, and she is really the reason that it got passed, and we're forever grateful to her. And she and her office did something that I've never seen done before and was actually really extraordinary. They brought us, the sort of campaigners in, all the sort of progressive groups and environmentally minded groups who were advocating for this, and we sat down in the room on one side of the table, and on the other side of the table, you had Pepco, you had Exelon, you had Washington Gas, you had the parking garage people, you had the hospital people, you had the university people, all the sort of major energy users and stakeholders around the table. And we did not agree. I can tell you, we had very firm disagreements about what the policy should be. And Mary Che's office said, we're going to sit down and we're going to talk until we reach consensus. And as a Quaker, I have a special fondness for consensus. And I thought, this is never going to happen. I mean, these aren't even actors who are coming to the table in good faith. These are actors coming to the table with entrenched financial interests. And we met for 2 hours and got nowhere. And we came back the next week and met for 2 hours and got nowhere. And we came back the next week and met for 2 hours and got maybe a step. And we continued to meet every Friday for 2 hours, locked in a room with people who were not our friends. I think we did that for like 3 months. It was sort of a running joke that we'd be doing this forever. And that this is how we were all spending our Friday afternoons in perpetuity. But believe it or not, so it was not an easy process. I mean, there were ups or downs. There were things that we really cared about that were taken from us, and we screamed and threw temper tantrums when it was taken out of the bill. And there were things that other people in the room really cared about that they lost. And I mean, I think it's the strongest bill we could have passed. And when I talk to like Washington Gas lobbyists, like, what do you think about the bill that passed? I heard him say, this is probably the best version of this that could have passed. So the fact that everyone around the room is saying that, and I think we actually did reach a kind of consensus, I think is kind of miraculous.
You ended up with a broad bill. It's an omnibus. It's got everything on the bus. Hits on a lot of the values Jeremiah was saying that the coalition had at the beginning. So without too much more commentary from me, let's go to one more musical break that happens to be my first grader's favorite song and very relevant to the issues at hand here. And after that, we'll talk about next steps after this law, implications for Maryland and the nation, and how can listeners get involved. So get out your pens, because we'll have some tips, and stay tuned.
Europe, Asia, Africa, Antarctica, and Australia. But the biggest thing everybody can see is that I got a lot of water all over me. I have oceans with lobsters, whales, otters. 3/4 of me is covered in water. I orbit the sun.
I'm so hot.
That's his line. And the moon orbits
it's
me.
My time to shine.
I'm filled with life, both big and small. The most beautiful planet of all.
Such a beautiful, such a beautiful, such a beautiful, beautiful world.
It is the home to every boy and girl. It's a beautiful, beautiful world. I'm getting homesick. Me too. Computer, take us home.
I'm Julie Hantman, and I'm talking with Jamie DeMarco of the Citizens Climate Lobby and Chelsea Hodgkins of DC Climate Coalition. And we're talking about the Clean Energy DC Act, which was passed into law on January 18th. Having passed the district council by unanimous vote on December 18th. We're almost near the end of our story about this law. Let's, though, before we talk about lessons learned and getting involved, let's just go bigger for a second. Jamie, you've worked in Maryland, where we are here today, with some of their efforts at going more green and energy, the new energy transition. So can you talk about what are there implications for Maryland from this and what's going on in Maryland?
There are implications in Maryland from this. When you talk to lawmakers, the scariest words you can say is nobody else has done this. Activists will sometimes want to tell that to lawmakers to get them excited, but that doesn't generally make lawmakers excited. That generally makes them panic because you don't know what the ramifications are going to be. To have DC just on our border commit to 100% clean electricity by 2032 secures and makes it easier for Maryland to make similar commitments. And we're advocating for the Clean Energy Jobs Act that would expand clean electricity. It would fund clean energy job training programs. It would fund clean energy businesses owned by women and people of color. And very importantly, it would say that burning trash does not count as clean energy.
So it's a similar package. What are the current targets for going renewable?
The law would require Maryland to get 50% of our electricity by 2030, and it would require the state to make a plan to get to 100% renewable electricity.
Fantastic. Now, you talked about carbon pricing. You work for an organization that champions that nationally. What is happening with carbon pricing in other states?
There's tremendous progress being made at the state level. Oregon, I think in the next 5 months, is going to put a price economy-wide on carbon, joining California's cap and trade market. I also think that Massachusetts and New York, before the end of 2020, are going to have a steadily rising fee on carbon. I hope the same for Maryland as well. There's a lot of beautiful, powerful, diverse campaigns out there to put a price on carbon.
Okay, fantastic. Chelsea, you are, as I said, point person for this coalition that helped get this law passed. There's still work to be done. What else needs to be done, and what's implementation mean of this bill?
Yeah, so I think One thing that has been very consciously thought about in this campaign is that the first step is getting the bill passed. The way that we actually win is making sure it gets funding. So the first step of that is actually agency budget and performance hearings are going to be happening in the district from February 6th until March 1st. Folks who want to sign up for that, I can share my information with Julia. Maybe she can send it later. But that is the first step in a, you know, 6-month-ish process.
Mm-hmm. And how can people get involved, Jamie, with Citizens Climate Lobby if they so choose?
The Citizens Climate Lobby has volunteers in every congressional district across the country, of upwards of 400 active chapters in every state. So DC has a chapter that meets every month and works systematically and effectively both for this bill that just passed and also for the national bill, the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act, that was introduced in Congress with Republican and Democratic support. And that bill would reduce U.S. emissions 40% in 12 years while putting more money back in middle and low-income folks' pockets.
Great. Now, I have just a couple tips of my own. If people feel like, hey, I just want to, you know, go a little slower on getting involved in climate action, there are many places to go. I noticed yesterday the yearsproject.com/act/weekly. You might have seen documentaries, The Years of Living Dangerously. So this is a spinoff. Theyearsproject.com. You can subscribe and get weekly tips. There's also endclimatesilence.org, which has some interesting information. And for basic kind of weather versus climate science and news on climate change, there's so many, but climatecentral.org, climatenexus.org has several offshoots. Check that out. And there's podcasts. Just search for climate change. Mothers of Invention has become a favorite of mine, and there's others as well. So let's just talk now at a personal level. Like I said, Chelsea and Jamie, you've been giving so much to this fight. What does this DC success mean to you personally?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much. I think for me, the biggest picture is that it's given me a sense of community around all this and a lot of hope. I think that this is a very challenging and very, like, depressing issue, right? We're talking about our culture changing. We're talking about the world as we know it becoming uninhabitable, particularly for some people. But yeah, it's given me a great community of people that are fighting really hard. And on that end, major shout out to Jeremiah Lowry, as you noted before, Asada Harris, who was also on this campaign, and Camila. I just want to echo, she's an incredible leader, and this bill would not have gotten through without her leadership.
Mm-hmm. Jamie, any thoughts?
It feels really good to win, is my first thought. you don't always or often get wins, and it feels really good. Nothing is predetermined. We didn't think this bill was going to pass right up until maybe like 2 months before it passed. We were fighting tooth and nail, always on the edge of falling off the cliff of failure. Getting something done is so much harder than getting nothing done. And
yeah,
Mike Tidwell from the Chesapeake Climate Action Network said that his two takeaways from this campaign are, if you build the strongest, most powerful, and wide-reaching coalition you can, and you never give up, if you follow those two steps, then you can do what no one else has ever done.
One thing that this campaign in particular has taught me is there's space for everybody in this movement. You don't have to be a leader if you don't want to be, right? There are people who are creating the plans, who are creating the opportunities for you to get plugged in. And volunteering, in my opinion, is one of the most important jobs you can do. I tell you, we've had more volunteers pack those rooms, and that has been so meaningful in showing the power of our movement, sometimes more than sitting in a council person's office.
Right, right.
I mean, I love this question about how can you bring more people in?
Yeah.
Because I think that to win on climate, we don't need to convince the most vehement climate deniers that climate change is a threat to our existence. I mean, that I'm not sure that's going to happen. I don't think we need it to happen. To win, we need the 10% of the population that cares most about the climate threat. And I'm talking to you, Tacoma Park. We need the 10% of the population that cares most about this threat to become as politically active and as engaged as humanly possible. And if we do that, there's nothing we can't accomplish.
Mm-hmm. People may have heard of these school walkouts happening in Europe, thousands of kids not going to school. Like, what's the point of going to school if we don't have a future? Putting it really, really starkly.
Yeah.
And it's not that the world's going to end in 12 years. It's, though, that if we don't act aggressively within 12 years, though, certain additional, you know, impacts that we wouldn't have seen will become baked into the system. So the time really is now. Yeah. Thank you guys so much. It's been an incredible conversation, and congratulations for your part in getting this law on the books. And thanks so much to Tacoma Radio. Stay tuned for Borderlines with Bobby Hill next on Tacoma Radio.